The Tom Woods Show, episode 1830.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, talking today about an important date in the history of Austrian economics. We're celebrating the 150th anniversary of it this very year. And of course, I want to start by making sure everybody understands what we mean by Austrian economics, especially, again, since I have a big batch of new listeners. It has nothing to do with the economics of Austria, which is a not very big European country. That's not the point. It's a school of economics, just like the Chicago School of Economics is not concerned about the economy of Chicago. It's just that its major practitioners come from the University of Chicago, and the early Austrian school economists come from Austria, although most Austrian economists today, I would say, are probably educated in the United States, so they're not Austrian. So that's not, it has nothing to do with being from Austria, by and large, except at the very beginning. But it's a school of economic thought to which such luminaries as Ludwig von Mises and F.A. Hayek, who won the Nobel Prize, belong, and a great many others. And of course, it so happens that a lot of libertarians and conservatives are very sympathetic to, or actually members of, the Austrian School of Economics. It's not a physical school, obviously. It's a way of thinking. It's an approach to economics. And it's an approach that, to my mind, brings economics alive, makes it seem real, realistic, apply to real people. It's readable. It's absorbing. You are instantly compelled to adopt it, I feel, when you read it. You feel like you're really learning about how the world actually works. So I even have a little recommended reading list I bought. LearnAustrianEconomics.com. And if you go there, you get a lot of recommendations for sources on this, how to get started in it. But anyway, 1871 was the year that Karl Menger wrote his book, Principles of Economics. And of course, here we are talking in 2021. So it's the 150th anniversary of that book. And that book really got the Austrian school started. So it seems appropriate for us to commemorate that. And I'm doing that with our old friend, Mark Skousen, who, of course, is the creator of Freedom Fest, which is the great libertarian gathering that's been going on for many years in Las Vegas. Not this year, though. This year, it's going to be in a different place. We'll talk about that. He is the author of many books, and he has published the investment newsletter Forecasts and Strategies for over 40 years. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Oh, delighted to be with you, Tom, on this glorious warm day in California, where I know you're headed for next month. We're looking forward to having you.
As a matter of fact, yes, we'll get to that. It's actually, oddly enough, kind of a chilly morning in Central Florida here. So, I mean, by chilly, I mean like 50s. But that's okay. I can certainly live with that a few days a year. But I'm very much looking forward to coming out to California. Now, even if people are listening to this episode months after the event has occurred, let me just say that there's still nevertheless some historical interest in the fact that we're doing this at this particular moment in time. So let's say a little something. We're speaking right now in 2021, and we're talking about something that you and I are going to do together. March 2nd, which is Murray Rothbard's birthday. I guess he would have been 95.
Yeah.
And so what exactly is that we're doing, Mark?
I'll tell you, it's really going to be a lot of fun. So we're at Padding Station, which is one of the speakeasies, so to speak, in Southern California in San Juan Capistrano. It's an Irish pub and restaurant that is open and has stayed open and is, you know, master optional. They have very much a libertarian streak as owners and defying the state in many ways. And this is a great venue for us to gather together. I mean, we're taking over the entire restaurant. 300 people can join us, and we're going to hear you speak on the virus and the two Americas. I'm looking forward to your presentation on that. And then I'm going to give a little talk on Murray Rothbard, how he changed my life. It's interesting that he will turn 95 on March 2nd, 2021, and he died in 1995. So it's kind of all the planets are lining up here for this wonderful occasion. We're getting a huge response. So we probably will sell out. So if people are interested in joining us, they need to do so right away.
Now, of course, we have an Eventbrite link, but there's no way I can give that out over the on the podcast. So what I've done is I've created a redirect. So by the time you guys are hearing this, it'd be much easier just to go to tomwoods.com/marktom, because it's Mark Skousen and Tom Woods. So tomwoods.com/marktom will take you directly to the Eventbrite page, and you can get your tickets and join us. And Mark is spelled with a K. So tomwoods.com/marktom. So I'm very much looking forward to that. Do we want to hold off on the Freedom Fest stuff until after we talk about Carl Menger?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So another important anniversary going on is this very year, because it was in 1871 that Carl Menger wrote the book Principles of Economics. And that was the book really that established the Austrian School of Economics. I mean, maybe there can be arguments sometimes in the history of thought as to who was the founder of what and what was the groundbreaking work. But this is a case where everybody is agreed. I was just this morning reading F.A. Hayek's introduction to Menger's book, and he pretty much says that, look, the Austrian school, and it being where it is due pretty much entirely to the foundations set by this one man. He couldn't have higher praise for principles of economics. So with this being 2021, we are now observing the 150th anniversary of the publication of this groundbreaking book. So, Mark, you say that this book also had a great influence on you. So let's have you try to describe for us why does it matter? What's so important about this book?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, of course, Hayek and Mises have gotten high praise and are considered kind of the leaders of the Austrian school. I mean, you have the Mises Institute as an example of that. There may be a Menger Institute, I don't know, but it might be over in Vienna. But, you know, what's interesting about Menger is that he did something that is unique. And I actually dedicated my book, The Structure of Production, as kind of my magnum opus, my contribution to technical economics and the introduction of gross output, the top line, and national income accounting. I mean, we've made so many advances since Menger came out with his Grundsatz or his Principles book. It's interesting that the book was not translated into English until 1950. And maybe that's one reason why he has not gotten the credit that Menger deserves. You know, I mean, he is considered one of the three economists, along with Jevons and Walras, Jevons from British and Walras, Swiss-French, in coming up with the marginalist revolution. And Menger is really considered the better of the three, in my opinion. But the structure of production is really my effort to advance Mengerian economics, Hayek's triangles, Mises' theory of the business cycle, all wrapped into one in my book, The Structure of Production, that was published by NYU Press in 1990. New York University Press has been, they're also the ones who published The Principles of Economics, Menger's book, in 1950. So with this long introduction by Hayek, which is really quite positive, Mises himself says, I became an economist because of Carl Menger. And so those of us who trying to figure out who's the greatest economist of all time, I actually put Menger in there as number one, primarily because he was the first economist who correctly identified the foundation of microeconomics with his subjective marginalist theory of value, and also macroeconomics with his time structure of production, the theory of the good. And if you put those two together, I mean, there's no other economist who has really done that. And so that's why I'm actually writing an article for a paper for a Fechterev on Menger, and I'm basically making the argument that he's the greatest economist who has ever lived.
Wow, that is something else. But as you say, you have pretty good authority agreeing with you on the significance of Carl Menger. Now, interestingly enough, if somebody in 2021 tries to read Menger's Principles of Economics, I think a person of reasonable intelligence will not find it a difficult book to get through. I remember once reading an article online where somebody was talking about the complicated concepts described in Principles of Economics, and I thought, you and I must be reading different books, because I found this a surprisingly easy book to read. I mean, if I were to say to the average person, Here's an economics book from 1871, written by a guy at the University of Vienna. Go ahead and read it. They'd probably think this is going to be, you know, like rocket science, but it's not. It's very, he had a great writing style. He's very clear. It's very accessible. It can be read. I mean, don't you feel that way?
Absolutely. And in fact, one thing I like about Menger is he had real world experience and actually discovered the structure of production, if you will, and the marginalist subjective value by studying the stock market. He was a reporter for a local newspaper in Vienna, and he covered the stock market. And it was in the stock market that he discovered that prices were not determined by any kind of cost of production or labor theory of value, but prices were determined by the buying and selling of a marginal number of traders. That's what determined the price of something, and it was totally subjective. So this was a brilliant insight, and he actually says that he wrote the principles, the Grundsatz, with rabid excitement because he had made this discovery and he wanted to get it out there. And so he published this book, and he actually said, my purpose was to improve upon the system of natural liberty and the model that Adam Smith had created in the Wealth of Nations. As you know, there's a lot of problems with the Wealth of Nations in terms of the foundation, and Murray Rothbard and others have pointed out the kind of a early labor theory of value that David Ricardo picked up and the classical economists. So Menger made this great discovery, and he wrote it up very quickly. He was never satisfied with the book, but it's full of practical examples. For example, to demonstrate subjective marginalist value, he uses the example of tobacco. And it's a very modern example. He says, suppose people decide they don't want to smoke anymore. What happens to the value of cigarettes? And of course, it goes to zero. And it has nothing to do with the labor, how much labor and how much cost is put into it. If people don't want to buy the product, the price goes to zero. And then he said, but what happens to the stages of production? What happens to the tobacco farm? Does the tobacco farm, does that go to zero? And he said, no, it goes to its next best use. So instead of the farmer producing tobacco, the farmer now says, well, we're going to switch to soybeans or wheat or corn or marijuana, or we're going to build condominiums. We're going to change the farm into some buildings. So whatever their next best use will determine the value. So that's, you know, opportunity cost comes out of that, marginal utility comes out of that, marginal cost comes out of that. And he uses this wonderful modern example of tobacco. So yes, it's really quite easy to read his works. In fact, his writing style is easier than Mises and Hayek. You know, they had that German approach that made it difficult. So I found it easier to read than Human Action or even Road to Serfdom.
Oh, much, much easier. Now, that point you made about with the tobacco example also underscores the centrality of the consumer in the Austrian analysis, because here we are looking at higher order capital goods, like a, you know, whatever goes into the production of tobacco, and we're thinking about where their prices come from. Now, he didn't maybe follow the entire analysis of how the prices of producer goods are derived, but he certainly gave us a pretty big clue by tracing it back to the demand of the consumer. If the consumer loses his taste for tobacco, the price of these goods will fall to zero if they're specific to the production of tobacco. And so it shows that it's not anything inherent in the item itself. It has to do with the subjective preferences of the consumer. And this is one of the central analytical aspects of Austrian economics that distinguishes it. And I'll say one other thing. I very much respect the classical economists. I mean, they wrote stuff and had insights that if I had 12 lifetimes, I wouldn't have stumbled upon. So I don't want to in any way show them disrespect. But as you say, you know, as with anybody developing a discipline, they don't get everything right. And when they're talking about price and what's the determination of how do prices come to be what they are, their emphasis tended to be on the long run when costs of production would more or less determine price. But the difference with Menger was that he was more interested in, well, what's the determinant of the prices I see at this moment, right now, this moment in time, not in some hypothetical long run, but what's causing these prices right here? And this is partly why we call this tradition causal realism. I mean, he starts his book with, all things are subject to the law of cause and effect. Now, that seems uncontroversial, but we should remember that the other economists who simultaneously discovered the marginal utility principle were not thinking that way. Stanley Jevons and Leon Walras, they, and this is how Peter Klein puts it in his own foreword, he says, they thought more in terms of simultaneous determination, the technique of modeling complex relations as systems of simultaneous equations in which no variable causes another, which is more or less the way modern economics looks at it. So Menger has a very common sense, man on the street, cause and effect approach to economics that probably seems quaint to people today, but I think is quite fruitful in understanding where real prices come from.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are really unusual about Menger. One is this imputation theory that he has, that basically consumer demand ultimately determines the structure of production and the costs involved. And the classical economists had it the other way around, where costs determine price. And you do see this in today's marketplace from time to time, cost plus pricing, where you determine what your price is, and then you add on a profit margin, and that's what your price is. But ultimately, the price is determined by how the consumer responds to those prices. And you can't always do a cost plus analysis. That doesn't always work, especially in commodities and stocks and so forth. To my students, I use the example of the stock market, and I say, so how much is Bill Gates worth as the wealthiest man in the world? And, you know, it's something like over $100 billion. And that's basically based on the value of his stocks in Microsoft, his position in Microsoft. And I say, so what happens if he decides to sell all of his stock tomorrow? Will he get $100 billion? And the answer is, of course, no, because the stock will collapse at that time. So the price of stocks and bonds and gold and all these and oil is all based on a small number of buyers and sellers who determine the price every day. And if you change that dynamic, if you suddenly find a bunch of people wanting to sell, then the price can collapse unless there's a huge increase in buying. You know, you saw this with this GameStop stock that went from $30 to $380 in a week. And that was based on marginal number of buyers and sellers. And at the same time, the reason it collapsed was because there were a small number of buyers and sellers, more sellers than buyers, and the stock went back down. So it's all based on marginal subjective value that has nothing to do with the cost of production. And that's really easy to get lost in business. The other example I use is real estate. What is the value of your real estate? Well, it's based on an estimate of what other homes are selling for, but only one out of every 30 homes in your community is up for sale at any one time. So who's to say, you know, that's marginal number of buyers and sellers. It's a fascinating field. You can really take Menger's initial views of the tobacco example, and you can extend it to all kinds of modern day examples.
I wonder if I can ask you something now that you're talking about investing that is not directly related to Menger, but nevertheless, since I have you on, I'm curious to ask you about. I've heard a number of different answers to the question of the extent to which knowledge of economics, you know, like for example, knowing Austrian economics very well, influences people's behavior as investors. And I'm not entirely sure that they're the same thing, or that, I mean, for example, Howard Buffett was good. Warren Buffett is the problem. He's not very good at understanding the economy as a whole, but he obviously knows what he's talking about when it comes to investing. What do you think the relationship, if any, is between those things?
Yeah, Warren Buffett is actually quite astute when it comes to business investing, and there may be some Austrian concepts that he uses to make these decisions. I think you have to separate, I mean, his views on taxation and his support of some of these Democratic proposals, I think, is missing the boat. I've actually written a book called A Viennese Waltz Down Wall Street, Austrian Economics for Investors. And I try to apply the principles of Menger, Mombarvik, and Mises, and Hayek, the theory of the business cycle, and some of the ideas that I've just been talking about, how prices are determined on the stock market by a small number of buyers and sellers. And that's why the stock price can move dramatically different from the fundamentals of the company. And Warren Buffett is pretty good on that. I mean, he learned his finance from Ben Graham, who said the stock market is a voting machine, not a weighing machine. Although long term it's a weighing machine, but short term it's a voting machine, and determined by these small number of buyers and sellers. And this is why Warren Buffett does take a long term approach to investing. In Austrian economics, that's what we do also. We don't want to look just at the short term. We want to look at the long term impact. That's what Henry Hazlitt, that's what Bastiat taught. And investors get into a lot of trouble when they just get focused on the short term. Warren Buffett once said, I wouldn't mind if the stock market was closed for 5 years. I mean, obviously that wouldn't be good because he has a publicly traded company. But the long term is a proper perspective, you know, time preference, savings, investing. That's all really long term investing. And we teach people that they can become financially independent if they take a long term view and they dollar cost average and they just keep adding to their position in companies that are doing well, that are profitable, and have a good future.
I want to ask you another quick thing on this line. You, I'm sure, heard that when it comes to something like Bitcoin, there are a lot of people who are just going to hold on to their Bitcoin come what may. Like, that's their strategy. They've got it, they have confidence in it, and they're just going to hold on to it. Now, not everybody feels that way. Not everybody has the confidence. Some of them need the cash. Well, whatever it is, they can't follow that position. But there are a lot of people who are just going to hold on to their Bitcoin come what may. And then when COVID hit, Bitcoin plummeted dramatically. And a lot of people, I think, probably got out of it. But the people who held on and held on and held on have been amply rewarded. Now, that's not a strategy that works, let's say, all the time with everything. But in this case, it does, at least for now, seem to have paid off. When COVID hit, I mean, I don't know all the things that where you have your money, but did you see a major downturn in anything related to that? And did that spook you? I mean, I'm just curious, like a seasoned investor seeing a once-in-a-lifetime world crisis unfolding, how does he respond to that?
So you have to make a decision on what is temporarily undervalued and what is permanently undervalued or long-term undervalued. You have to be really careful in that decision. This is something I learned from Sir John Templeton, who was a very astute investor, obviously passed away, so was not around during 2020 when we saw this event. So as an investor, you have to make that kind of decision. And my view was that this was some kind of a temporary, this was really a unique situation. The lockdown was totally artificial, imposed by government. I couldn't see how this could last very long. And even with the bailouts and so on, you have to get back to producing goods and services. You can't rely on an economy where we just keep giving people free money and they go out and spend it. That doesn't work. You have to get back to work. So I made the decision. So I just stayed the course. And even though my stocks dropped 30%, I stayed with them. Same thing with Bitcoin. And I've been rewarded because of it, but it is a judgment call. And I could see why people were saying, hey, this is the beginning of the end, that this pandemic is never going to go away. And the Democrats and the Chinese, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories that were going on out there. I think it was just blunders. And we also gave way too much imperial authority to governors to engage in this kind of lockdown behavior. And the studies have all shown that this was really a bad behavior and was a big mistake. They're still are engaging in it to some extent. So, yeah, it's a really tough decision because For example, 2007, 2008, 2009, which was the previous real bear market, and stocks fell 50%. Again, what was the Federal Reserve doing? It wasn't doing like they did in the 1930s and kept money tight during that entire period. They opened the floodgates. And so you have to be alert to that. You need to know the signs of the times. And the Austrian theory of the business cycle says Federal Reserve policy is critical to understanding the ups and downs of the stock market and the economy. And when the Fed was throwing money into the system with quantitative easing 1, 2, 3, and 4, you knew that this was not going to be a replay of the 1930s. And all my doom and gloom gold bug friends thought it was, and they miscalculated, and they just, you know, jumped into gold and silver, which peaked out in 2011 and had a bear market that lasted 8 years. So you have to really be careful with these kinds of situations.
All right, now let's talk about the issue we've been postponing, which is the change of venue for Freedom Fest in 2021. Not Las Vegas in 2021, maybe in the future, but let's say a place where that you can count on a little bit more, not to pull the rug out from under you at the very last minute. And where would that be?
Yeah, so what happened was the lockdown in Las Vegas was, you know, there was a great deal of uncertainty because, I mean, I'm still astonished that the money powers of Las Vegas didn't win in this battle with the politicos, the governor of Nevada, and the state authorities, the gaming commission, and so forth. We realized that they have incredible amount of power. So we were working with Caesar's Palace, with Caesar's Entertainment. We did everything we could to put it together. We had 3 different breakout rooms, general sessions. It was going to be very expensive. We were going to have to do the masking. And we followed every rule and regulation that Caesar's arranged. And they said we are working very closely with the governor's office and the gambling people in Vegas. And then they pulled the rug out from us and just canceled us the last minute. There was no apology. There was no hearings, no offer to compensate the several $100,000 that I personally lost because of this. So we lost a lot of faith in Las Vegas. Now we hope to return. We've been there for 14 years. I mean, we are hopeful that we will return next year. But this has developed into a really interesting scenario because we decided to move out of Sin City, Las Vegas, and we moved to the Badlands of South Dakota in the middle of the country to Rapid City. And they have a convention hall there that can seat 3,000 people or more. The response has been tremendous. I mean, we were surprised how many people want to try something, another location for our Freedom Fest conference. We already have 1,100 people who have signed up. So we have 6 months to go. So this is going to be quite thrilling. And amazing how many people have not been to Mount Rushmore. A lot of people are going to make it a family vacation and the hotel rooms. We already have 3 of the hotel rooms. The hotels sold out. So we're just getting a huge response, and I'm very excited about having the Tom Woods Day. That's going to be 3 sessions in a row where you determine who the speakers are and the topics, and we have you as the judge for our mock trial. So that's going to be exciting as well. Our theme is healthy, wealthy, and wise, and the old Ben Franklin trilogy of success in life: healthy, wealthy, and wise. And we're going to have a lot of healthy experts. We have Dr. Drew coming up, John Mackey, CEO of Whole Foods, who's written extensively on living to be 120, healthy for that long time. And we have lots of other speakers as well. We are going to have a special session on the Austrian School, the sesquicentennial. We're going to have a session on Murray Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, his new 5th volume, where he attacks the Constitution. So that's going to be a fun debate to discuss there. And there's lots of, you know, we have the Anthem Film Festival. Oh, one thing that we are going to do that's really cool is we're going to be showing clips from the new docufilm Reagan with Dennis Quaid. And Dennis Quaid, we haven't confirmed him, but there's a very good chance that he is going to make an appearance there. So there's a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement, people, a lot of people driving there, flying there, biking there to Rapid City. And it's really going to be a fun event. I think people are very excited about it. The dates, by the way, are July 21st through the 24th. That's a Wednesday through Saturday. And we are being hosted and greeted by the governor, Kristi Noem. A lot of people are very excited about her and that she could be presidential material in 2024. So she will be there along with all the other market tanks and organizations. It's always a really fun event, as you know.
Oh, I do know, and I was looking forward to last year's, frankly, very much, and I love the idea of the Tom Woods Day. I have some ideas. I got to run them by you. I got to ask you some questions, so we'll do that through email over the next 24 hours. But I'll say that Jenna and I took a little vacation to South Dakota last year because, well, where else were we going to go? I mean, in terms of a place where, you know, most of the attractions you'd want to see would be open. And of course, a lot of the attractions in South Dakota are outdoors anyway. And we actually went on the very first hike either one of us had ever gone. I'm not a hiker. You take a look at me. It's pretty clear. I'm no hiker. But we went in Custer State Park. We hiked Lover's Leap Trail. And we were so proud of ourselves. We did this. We got up at the crack of dawn just to make sure we avoided the heat. And so I would say if you're planning on hiking in July, I don't know if that's a great idea, but definitely get up super, super early. Get your hike done before the heat comes. But there are plenty of things to see and do. You could very easily make a very, very enjoyable vacation out of it. And the sorts of topics we're going to be covering at Freedom Fest and the people who are going to be there, it's a very diverse array of people. You're not going to agree with everybody at Freedom Fest. That's what makes it fun. So the website, I presume, is freedomfest.com?
Yep, that's correct. And we are planning quite a few excursions to Deadwood, for example, where they do have legal gambling, and to Chief Crazy Horse Monument, to Mount Rushmore. We're actually going together as a group Thursday evening during the conference. I think that'll be July 22nd. We're going to be doing that. So there's lots of people who are doing excursions before and after. We're taking over the entire city. It's really amazing. In fact, the Chamber of Commerce there thinks that we will pump in $5 million in 1 week spending with all our entire group. And they said that's more than what we get in an entire year. So they are pulling out the red carpet for us. This is going to be a wonderful occasion for everybody to spend time and get to meet the local people there.
Well, I hope some of the folks listening right now will seriously consider this. I'm sure if you're like me, you've at least thought about South Dakota as a place to visit. You know, we finally went and pulled the trigger and did it, partly because you've probably never been there. There are things to see. It's a beautiful place. And partly because, frankly, you want to thank those people for being a model for the rest of us. You want to be part of that. You want to kind of remind yourself what normal life used to look like. There's a lot of reasons to do it. And Freedom Fest is going on simultaneously. So check that out, freedomfest.com. The old man here will be there, as Mark said, and I'm very much looking forward to that. And remember also the event that Mark and I are doing together coming up March 2nd, Murray Rothbard's birthday in, I guess, San Juan Capistrano is where the place is?
Yeah, it's called Padding Station is the name of the restaurant. They can only hold 300 people, and we've already sold almost half the tickets. So, I mean, it's going pretty quickly. So if you do want to come, you want to sign up. There's a cover charge of $10. And but don't plan on coming directly at the door because it's probably going to be sold out at that point. But it really is going to be a fun occasion. And we do have some local musicians playing as well. There'll be some dancing, just lots of fun things to do. And you want to show up at 6 and have a dinner there, order your own dinner or drinks. And then our program will start at 7:30. So it's really going to be a lot of fun. People want to get out. They're tired of being sequestered in their homes.
Right, exactly. We're going to give them an opportunity. So the link again is tomwoods.com/marktom. And I'll put that also on our show notes page, because on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/1830, I'm also going to link to where you can read Menger's Principles of Economics for free online. So, because that is the world we live in, ladies and gentlemen. Well, thanks, Mark, very much. And I'm looking forward to seeing you next month.
All right, Tom. Thank you. AEIOU. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Before we wrap up another week of Tom Woods Show episodes, let me point out that today I just went to visit some event space at a venue in Orlando that is just stunning and that I feel fairly certain we're going to book for the 2000th episode event in Orlando, October 16th. The 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show is going to be commemorated by one heck of an entertaining evening that will cost you nothing to get into and will feature some of your favorites and some just a lot of fun entertainment. Just a great night out, as I say, will not cost you a cent. It's my gift to you. And this property where I've booked the space is a four-diamond hotel resort. It's just stunning and top-notch. And it's my gift to you. You just show up and we're going to entertain you and have a lot of fun together. So October 16th, save the date. I will eventually give out information about registering. It doesn't cost anything, but it really would help me if people would register so that I have a sense of the kind of numbers I'm looking at. So I will get back to you on that. But please set aside October 16th, it's a Saturday, 2021, for the 2000th episode event of the Tom Woods Show. We did one, as you'll recall, for the 1000th episode. You can find the video of that on YouTube and enjoy it even now. It's quite entertaining, the various things we did at that event. Well, this one's going to be bigger and better. And the venue, even though we were at the Rosen Center last time, which is a great venue, there are a lot of major events have taken place there. We've actually moved up half a diamond in terms of the quality of the location. So I'll be giving you more details soon, but please, please, please save the date. Bring your friends. You want to visit Florida anyway. You can make a vacation out of it. There's obviously a lot to do down here. And, you know, life's pretty normal down here. So bring your libertarian friends and have a blast. So remember that date, and I will be giving you more details soon. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.